Today on Peace Talks Radio, we explore the therapeutic use of psychedelic drugs to address trauma in a pursuit of inner calm and peace. We'll hear from researchers and clinicians.
It means that somebody witnessed or participated in something that's such an affront to their morals that they then have to reorganize how they see the entire world. Wrapped up in that is a lot of guilt and shame and not knowing what to do with it. And under MDMA, you just sort of know what you have to deal with it.
And meet a social worker in the UK who's been in a trial.
You know, one of the motivating factors that influenced me, because I was looking at these studies, they were treating people who had like PTSD, people who'd been diagnosed with like terminal cancer, people that were saying like, I don't just feel better, I feel transformed.
Finding peace and mental health through the therapeutic use of psychedelic drugs on this episode of Peace Talks Radio. Since this episode was recorded, the FDA has declined to approve the use of MDMA as a treatment for post-traumatic stress disorder. Experts say the work is far from over and the research will continue. This is Peace Talks Radio, the radio series and podcast on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution. I'm Jessica Tickton, in for series producer Paul Ingalls. Today, correspondent Daniel Price will help us delve into the world of psychedelics, such as MDMA and psilocybin, and explain how they're being used as part of therapeutic practice and what the research is saying about how they work. After a golden age of research in the 1950s and 60s, research on therapeutic uses of psychedelic drugs were grounded for much of the 20th century after they were classified as Schedule I drugs, meaning they have no medical use and a high potential for abuse. In recent years, though, scientists have challenged those assumptions, and this line of research has started to gain new momentum, with particular focus on how these substances may relieve suffering for people struggling with trauma and PTSD. Scientists are still trying to understand exactly how they work therapeutically, but believe substances like MDMA, psilocybin, and LSD help the brain rewire in a way that allows new perspectives on psychiatric problems. While these drugs may be better known for their recreational uses, researchers say they have huge potential to help people struggling with mental health conditions that are sometimes resistant to other treatments or require indefinite use, like antidepressant medications. First, we'll hear from Shannon Miller, a licensed clinical social worker and the owner of Apricity Expat Therapy, who works with clients who use psychedelics. We'll also hear from Sean, a humanitarian aid worker from the UK who tried psilocybin, commonly known as magic mushrooms, as a therapeutic to address issues around trauma. Later in the program, we hear from a researcher about the science behind these powerful substances and why they have the power to heal. Now, here's Daniel Price with Shannon Miller.
What do we understand about how psilocybin-supported therapy works?
So what we're coming to understand is that it's happening on two levels. There is a biochemical thing happening in the brain where it allows both sides of the brain to better talk to each other, and it builds neuroplasticity. And it's during that window of neuroplasticity that we can get in there with some really good therapy and build the new neural networks. The other thing that's happening is, again, under the influence of psilocybin, we don't get hung up on details or fluidity of stories and things like that. Things just come at us in pieces, and we seem to know what to do with it. And so it's, again, getting to that inner healing intelligence without getting caught on the details. You just sort of flow with it a bit better, and it's more of a perceived sense of what you have to do rather than something that can be articulated. You kind of don't need words in the experience. You just know.
As a therapist, what is your role when you sit with clients who are taking psychedelic medication?
I'm not giving the medication. I'm not managing it. I'm not making any decisions about it. I'm just the safety blanket that's in the room with them. I'm the comfort zone that they have because presumably I have a pre-existing relationship with them.
What is it like to walk someone through this experience as their therapist?
If someone says, hey, I'm going to do this, can you come with me? And basically trip sit for me. I, of course, agree to it 9 times out of 10 if I'm comfortable. If I think that's a good choice for that person, then yes, I will do it. How other organizations do it is that the guide shows up, they bring the medication with them. There's a lot of talk, so everybody gets comfortable and familiar with each other. The guide will make the mushrooms, grind them up, and put them into a tea format. and then hand it to the client, and the client chooses to take however much they want at whatever pace they want. And eventually when they start to feel the effects coming on, they go climb in bed, put a face mask on, and listen to music. I've seen it start with a guided meditation, go into music. Some people don't want music, but most of the time they do. It tends to really guide the trip very well. And then for about 5 hours, they're having their experience. And then when the experience kind of comes to a close, the guide makes himself available to then talk it through with them about whatever they want to talk through. In my experience, what I have seen is that people don't necessarily want to talk right away. And so then a guide will stick around until the person essentially says, hey, I'm okay. And the guide feels comfortable that the person is sober enough and that they're not a danger to themselves or anyone else. And then I myself begin working with that person the following day to sort of integrate their experience. And that just means, okay, what was that like for you? And what did that mean? And why do you think that came up? And what's the meaning you assign to that? My job is to help them process.
Is the guide initiating conversation or discussion with people, or is it totally up to them?
Completely the client led. So each person typically wants something very different from their guide. I have seen where people just lay there stiff as a board and don't move for 4 or 5 hours. I have seen where people want to be up and walking around, which we don't really, the guide didn't encourage that, you know, because it again distracts from the actual trip. We want you to be internal to yourself. It's not really an external experience. So you're wearing a face mask and we're encouraging you to stay in your mind. This, again, this isn't recreational. I've seen the guide redirect over and over back internal to them.
And what about the music? Are the clients choosing the music themselves? Are there specific types of music that better support the experience?
There's playlists on Spotify, you know, for all of it, and they're pretty good. There's also a new website out where as a therapist or as a guide, you can tailor the music very specifically to the drug, the client, the length. Like there's a whole science to the music that's, I think, emerging through this, particularly this one guy's work that I'm seeing.
That's fascinating. Shannon Miller, what kinds of things do people tell you about their experiences afterwards? What impacts have they seen?
I have seen, well, first of all, I always warn people that are pursuing psychedelic assisted therapy, you know, we kind of go over expectation management that, yeah, this is something you can go do, but it's not going to be a cure-all. And I've heard the analogy, and I think it's a brilliant one, is like, when you're done doing it, it's going to feel like summer, but winter always returns. Everybody describes it as very, very powerful. And they get their intentions addressed, but not in the way that they thought that they would. So we encourage people to ask the medication a question. And that question is universally answered, but not in any way, shape, or form. Like it's actually very surprising to them, but it makes 100% sense, complete sense to them.
Yeah. And I would assume that the question is also completely individual, that people are doing that based on what their needs are.
Yeah. But a trend that I've seen, and again, I've not worked with like tons and tons of people, but what I have seen is universally, it's like relational things, right? Of people wanting to connect better with either someone or something in the world around them.
Are people ever expressing that they're scared?
Absolutely, yes. So there tends to be some anxiety going into it, where I've worked with people calming them down because they're afraid of what the medication's going to show them. What they are actually is afraid of themselves. And they can always choose like, okay, I changed my mind. I don't want to do it. But then when they're in the trip, some people, it activates things that they have long since tucked away somewhere. And it can be very scary. But I will say, it's never more than the person can handle. It's never like these horrible, like, super bad trip, man. It's never that kind of stuff at all, ever. It may bring up things that were particularly frightening or saddening to you, but you can handle it.
Is that part of the therapeutic approach, bringing up these things?
Yeah, because that's the stuff that you need to touch and to get in there and to heal.
I was able to speak with someone who has firsthand experience trying psilocybin therapeutically. Sean is a humanitarian aid worker from the UK. Due to the stigma around psychedelic use, she prefers to use only her first name. Sean wanted to explore issues around intergenerational trauma, the idea that traumatic things that happen to your parents, grandparents, or great-grandparents can affect you. But also, like most people, Sean has dealt with some hard things in life. Her mother passed away some years back, and the end of a long-term relationship was difficult. She's also worked in conflict zones, where she worked with people who had suffered a lot and was sometimes in scary and dangerous situations herself. So she wanted to see how these substances might help her understand those traumas. Here's my conversation with Sean about her experience.
Do you remember, like, what you thought about it when you first understood it? Like, was it something you had ever considered that you might do?
At the time that I first was aware that it was something that people were using, definitely not. Because what I was reading about was people who'd experienced like really significant trauma. So it was things like soldiers returning from Vietnam, people with like extremely severe PTSD. And I was like 19 or 20. So that probably felt like a long way from my experiences then. So
psychedelics are used to treat a variety of mental health conditions. For example, depression, PTSD, demoralization. What kind of thing were you looking to address with the therapeutic psychedelics?
So the work that I've been doing with my therapist has been like really wide ranging because we've been like speaking to each other for a long time. But the main thing was around, I wanted to explore this idea of generational trauma. So this idea that like the things that your parents have experienced get like indirect, or maybe even your like, grandparents or great grandparents get like indirectly kind of passed down to you. And it seemed like a kind of good forum to explore that. But because you can't necessarily like pick and choose what's going to come up, I was also aware that because of like my job and like just things that have happened to me over the course of like my adult life, I was also aware that I've also like picked up some like direct traumas. And so I just wanted to see if it would help me to like process some of those things.
And can you now kind of walk me through the experience? So if you can start from the beginning as much as possible and just kind of explain what it was like.
So the location was in Amsterdam. So like kind of mid-morning, we started. There was two people like guiding me. So there was my therapist, who of course I knew. And there was this other guy, her colleague, who is like a kind of mushroom expert. So he was in charge of like dosing. And what happens is they like explain to you about like what's going to happen. And like the kind of key difference from like most people's experience with mushrooms or probably with any drug recreationally is that you're going to be alone for the experience. I drank the mushroom tea, and then I don't know, maybe like a few minutes after that, I like went and laid down. So you're wearing like a kind of airplane face mask. They're playing some like music for you. So it starts off, I think it's like Alan Watts. It was like something that I knew that to start with. And they say, look, like if you want something, if you want to take a break, like it's cool. Of course, they maybe need the toilet because it's going to last for like 8 hours. And the snacks and stuff, you know, I wouldn't have picked them. There was there was grapes. What else was there? There was mango. There's some crisps. You're like laying down and, you know, you have like the typical experience of, you know, starting to feel kind of like slight like body temperature changes. It's a really strange experience because you're looking, initially it's black, and then it's like, for me it was like a kaleidoscope, and the kaleidoscope was like, for me, was like extremely like multicolored. You've got no like sense of time. like you're advised like not to like have your watch or like your phones, but somebody said, oh, you've just got to like follow the river. Yeah, you got to follow the river. It's a little bit like watching a film that you're like a little bit in control of. I mean, if you've ever had like a dream, like a lucid, is it a lucid dream, mm-hmm. where you can kind of like control. It's a little bit like that, except that things are coming, it feels like from like very, very deep inside of you. So like in my case, I was seeing things like my dad, seeing him like transform into like these other people that I didn't know. But it seemed to me like they were like relatives, like going like back into time.
Then were you, when you were seeing these figures of these people that seemed to be relatives or ancestors, mm-hmm. like, were they doing anything? Was anything happening? Was there like, were there specific traumatic things that you could like see expressed?
Yeah, that's how it started. Like that was at the beginning. It was kind of like a play. They would sort of show me things about myself. They didn't speak to me directly, but it was like they were kind of showing me things. I mean, this probably isn't like an uncommon experience, but I think like I carry like a bit of uncertainty and worry that maybe I'm the decisions that I've made are maybe not right, that maybe I'm not like making other people kind of proud. And it felt like they were trying to communicate something to me, but it was a very like metaphorical message. So it's something that I think you have to kind of interpret. And when the whole thing finished, I spent a long time like kind of furiously writing. And to be honest, like some of it, I still don't feel like I fully understand.
Because you said that you had wanted to address kind of intergenerational trauma, so that it sounds like maybe that's what was happening when you were seeing this vision of your father and relatives going back. Mm-hmm. But had you like set an intention to see that?
I had set an intention, like I'd written down like what I wanted to explore. The guy who was accompanying me, he said to me, you know, the mushroom is the medicine, like it knows what you need to look at and consider. And that did kind of feel like that's what happened.
Did you feel scared ever during the trip?
Yes, I did. It wasn't traumatic, I suppose is the right word to say. But I did have some like moments of fear, because one of the things, and you know, again, like people may have had this experience when they take drugs recreationally, but you know, you sort of see yourself unvarnished. And so one of the things that happened to me is that I had a bit of a freak out at one moment, because I started to feel like really, really guilty about like a relatively like trivial thing that had happened like 2 days before. I wasn't allowed to have my phone, and I just like made a decision like in that moment I needed to like rectify that problem, you know. But that's the reason why you have the guys there, because they were like, look, you know, having some feelings, but it's not really like a big deal. You just like chill, like eat some snacks. And then like after sort of like 15-20 minutes, I calmed down again. But I didn't spend like the whole period in the like process that I was supposed to be having wearing the mask. I would say I did like half of it, again, to like use this metaphor of the river. I felt like I was at like the limit of what I could carry, and maybe also like what I could kind of remember and therefore like would be able to process. So like at some point I had my therapist with me, who I know, she was sat next to me. I was kind of talking through with her some of the things that I'd seen and that were kind of on my mind. I mean, everybody's experience is going to be like very unique, and I definitely wouldn't want anybody to have any fear if they were considering to do it that anything dramatic would happen. But I would really, really recommend that. I'm not sure if I'd have been in like a really like messy emotional place like at that time, if it would have been valuable for me, because even this like relatively like trivial thing really kind of messed with me, because you need to be able to relax, and you also need to have like some confidence that like whatever's going on in your life with like work and your family, that everything's sort of going to be okay. While you want to do it at a moment where you have actually got like the time and like the men, not just the physical time, but like the mental space to just be able to concentrate on it with no feeling of like, oh, I should be somewhere else or doing something else.
I spoke also with a therapist and a researcher who work on therapeutic psychedelic medicine. And they both talked about how this kind of medicine kind of helps you access things maybe in your subconscious and helps you see them in a different way. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if you had that type of experience.
Yeah, I did. I think I'm very lucky because of the job that I do and the life that I'm living, I don't have to like day to day put on too much of a like a mask or like a sort of special hat while I'm like going about my everyday life. But even so, you know, we're all like keen to sort of present our best selves. And I think one of the like negative things that I kind of picked up from where I grew up and like the family that I grew up in is that like if something that you don't like happens to you, you know, keep it moving. You know, I think that works quite well when you're a kid and you fall over, but it doesn't work so well when you have got a kind of like mounting, you know, like personal kind of crises. Because of the nature of the job that I do, I've like sometimes I've been in situations where like not very nice things have happened, and I've had to kind of like swallow that and keep going. I do think it does help you to see things in another light, but that's not necessarily gonna like click your fingers and that solves the problem. I don't think anybody, at least for me, I can only speak for myself, I didn't get to the end of the experience, like at the end of that day, I wasn't like laying in bed about to go to sleep thinking like, oh super, like that's sorted, you know, on back to work. It kind of like gives you a glimpse, if you like, of the, helps you to sort of see in totality, like, why have you made some of the decisions that you've maybe made? Like, what is the impact of some of the things that you've maybe experienced? But then that's really helpful. But you also then need to kind of do the work of, like, you still need to like make decisions. You still need to like maybe make changes, whether that's like practical changes or like changes in the way that you're gonna like go through your life. And, you know, I'm sure it's perfectly possible that you could like have the experience and been like, oh, that's very interesting, and just like carry on. That's why I think it's helpful to do it with a therapist. And in my case, I was obviously doing it with a therapist that I knew quite well.
How long ago was it that you did it?
It's like 2 months ago.
And do you feel like you have any different thoughts or insights about the issues you were looking to address through the session now that there's been some space from it?
I mean, I'd quite like to do it again, actually. I feel like I only kind of scratched the surface, and it felt like there was some really big, like, identity related things that I needed to process. There's like all of these other things that I could have explored, but that I didn't. So I would definitely be open to doing it again.
How open are you talking to people in your regular life about the fact that you did this?
I have like told a few people. I think it's really interesting because I think that the reasons that I went to do it are like completely legitimate. And if I said to somebody, okay, you know, like there are some just like facts that are things that have happened, like my mum died, like that was quite traumatic. I had like a like very like long-term relationship, and I worked in war zones and I've done it for like over 10 years. Like there are things that are just like sort of factual things that I think, and for sure, like with my friends and also with like a lot of my family, that they would be like, it's important that you like make sure that you're doing, you know, getting like help if you need to have help. You know, I do, I do carry like a bit of concern that I'm worried about what people will think about it, because it's not quite, to make like a very poor comparison, it's not like with like marijuana, you know, but people use it for pain relief. I mean, I think that's like quite well accepted now. And because that's a sort of physical thing, I think like most people would be like relatively tolerant about that. I would be like concerned that it would like change people's perception of me.
I think that's a good comparison with marijuana though, because I remember even, I don't know, maybe 5 years ago or something, my grandmother was using medicinal marijuana for pain related to cancer treatment. And even still, it was kind of like hush hush that grandma was doing it. And there was nobody thought that she was getting high in her spare time, but it was still like,
I think we're in a period, luckily, of like quite profound and fast moving change, which is great. You know, it's really good that people are becoming like more open to the idea. And I think it's like super cool, especially in America, that although perhaps where like maybe the problem started in terms of the war on drugs, but you know, putting that aside, I think it's really cool that researchers are now being given like license to actually be able to explore and be able to give some, to actually present some evidence and say like, look, this is the effect that this can have. But I'm more concerned about like the older generation who grew up with like a very, like there's a lot of people who grew up with like a very, very zero tolerance attitude to drugs, like perhaps like your grandparents, like certainly my grandparents were like very zero tolerance, admittedly not with alcohol, but but with every, with, you know, with almost everything else. And so there's just like a lot of, there's like a lot of like unpicking that needs to happen, because the real tragedy is that we've had access to these things all the time. And I have, you know, I have friends who are much more like educated on it than me. And they say that like there are people who have been attempting to provide, they've been attempting to provide this kind of therapeutic service for people with these drugs for like many, many years. And, you know, and they've basically been sidelined and maligned in some cases, you know, because we have these like stereotypes about like hippies and I have those stereotypes too. And yet like if you kind of remove all of that kind of cultural baggage that we have, what we actually have is something that like it does help people. I was looking at these studies, okay, admittedly they're for like very different things, but they were treating people who had like PTSD, people who'd been diagnosed with like terminal cancer, people that were saying like I don't just feel better, I feel transformed. No medicines like have that impact on people. Like it's so uncommon. I'm sad that it's taken a long time, but I'm also like very grateful that you know, within my lifetime we're having the opportunity to kind of trial it. And you know, I did say I don't want to really talk about it because I do feel a bit, I've got like complicated feelings about it. But I do hope that people, if people feel like it can help them and they're able to access it, then I really like would want to encourage people to do that, because the more we normalize it, I think the more likely we're going to be putting pressure on our policymakers to make changes, make investment, to like change their way of thinking.
That was Sean, a humanitarian aid worker from the UK who tried psilocybin as a therapeutic to address issues around trauma. We also heard from Shannon Miller, a licensed clinical social worker and owner of Apricity Expat Therapy. Shannon is trained in integration of psychedelic use into therapy through MAPS, the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. You can find links to some of the Spotify playlists used during psychedelic therapy sessions at peacetalksradio.com. After the break, Daniel Price will speak with a researcher to explain the science behind these powerful substances and how they can help a brain damaged by trauma to heal. Stay tuned. listening to Peace Talks Radio, the radio series and podcast on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution. I'm Jessica Tickton, in for series producer Paul Ingalls. How do psychedelic medicines actually interact with therapy? Today, correspondent Daniel Price takes us into the world of psychedelics being used for healing trauma. We heard a first-person account from Sean earlier, and also from licensed clinical social worker Shannon Miller, who we'll hear more from in this hour. Shannon is trained in the process of integrating psychedelic experiences into therapeutic practice and helps clients who have tried psychedelics work through what they've discovered during their trips. Before we hear more from Shannon Miller, though, Daniel Price first interviews Dr. Jennifer Mitchell, a professor in the UCSF Department of Neurology and Associate Chief of Staff for Research and Development at the San Francisco VA, about the science behind these drugs as therapeutic tools.
Dr. Jennifer Mitchell, can you tell me a little bit more about the work that you do?
Sure. For many years now, our group has been involved in identifying and developing novel therapeutics for mental health disorders like depression, anxiety, alcohol, and substance use disorder, etc. And for the past 8+ years now, that work has focused on the testing and development of a class of drugs that we term psychedelics.
And what exactly is a psychedelic drug?
Well, I think it kind of depends who you ask, but the word means mind manifesting. And the idea is that a psychedelic compound allows you access to parts of your subconscious, perhaps, or parts of your mind that might otherwise often be hidden from view. And that this aspect of view can help garner some sort of insight that might make you better.
How did you first get into the field of psychedelic medicine?
I'm a native San Franciscan. And so as a child, and I'm old, I was born in 1970. And so as a child, I was sort of perfectly poised to see some of the good and the bad of psychedelic use within the community. And I remember sort of being afraid of them as a very young child, because you'd hear these sort of whispers, oh, you know, poor Danny, he took too much LSD and he's never come back. But then in early adolescence, I saw them in action. I went to a high school that had a lot of psychedelic use in San Francisco. And I was sort of amazed by this idea of like almost a tabula rasa. Like, it brought people back to sort of like this childhood state of innocence and curiosity and opportunity. And so you could see that in the wrong hands, that could be very damaging. But that in the right hands, it was this incredible opportunity for healing and growth. And so by the time I was in college, and I thought, this is crazy. I mean, somebody's really got to get back in there and study these compounds. And then in graduate school, I remember asking if I could have access to some of them through one of these National Institutes of Health called NIDA. And I was told no. And so we instead spent some time contemplating their effectiveness and reverse engineering some of those effects as best we could. You could sort of mimic the effects pharmacologically, and you could see what that does to behavior. So we did that for a long time until finally I heard that MAPS, which is now called Lykos, had put money together for a phase 3 trial in humans. And we were lucky enough to be invited to join those studies.
What types of psychedelics are being looked at by researchers currently?
Well, there are a whole bunch, but the top three, I think, are MDMA, which is being investigated as a therapeutic for PTSD. And psilocybin, which is otherwise known as magic mushrooms, and that's being looked at as a treatment for depression. And then LSD, which is being studied as a treatment for generalized anxiety disorder. There are other compounds as well that we know, based on their use in indigenous groups, seem to have some sort of therapeutic efficacy, but these have yet to be thoroughly tested in clinical trials.
Okay, great. Can you tell me a little bit about how MDMA works? So first off, what is it exactly for people who don't know?
MDMA is shorthand for 3,4-methylenedioxymethamphetamine, and it's a substituted amphetamine. So it has sort of an amphetamine backbone to it. And in the 80s, maybe even early 90s, it was used mostly as a street drug called ecstasy. And the idea is that Well, there are two things. First of all, on a neurosciencey level, we believe that the drug acts in a part of the brain called the amygdala, and also on a circuit in the brain that enables plasticity and new learning and growth. So that's on sort of a neurosciencey level. On more of an interpersonal level, what they'd found back in the 70s and 80s is that when you administered MDMA to somebody, especially in a therapeutic environment, they were very able to open up and access emotionally things that had happened to them in a way that didn't manifest as shameful or scary or embarrassing, and that this helped tremendously in a therapeutic setting.
And do we know why exactly that's happening? I mean, is the research able to connect what is happening at a neuroscience level with those impacts that you just described?
To some degree, yes. I mean, a lot of our neuroscience research depends on animal models. And so you can't really look at a rat and say, are you feeling better? How do you feel about your childhood? But what you can do is, a series of behavioral tests that suggest that one of the important things that MDMA is doing is it's allowing a retrieval and then reconsolidation of a fear-laden memory in a way that perhaps removes some of the emotional valence. We know where in a brain exactly that's happening. Again, it's happening at the level of the amygdala. And that process of retrieval and reconsolidation is likely key for the therapeutic benefit of MDMA.
Is it possible to break that down just a little bit, exactly what you mean by emotional valence?
Sure. So in general, as an example, this is sort of a very, maybe this is a little bit of a fluffy example, but the idea is that perhaps if you have a memory that is particularly salient and particularly painful, and you have a tendency to let your mind wander there and relive it over and over again, that perhaps the MDMA is going to help remove some of that emotional valence from the memory. So you'll still remember it, but it won't trigger that sort of pain in your tummy or the rapid heartbeat or the breathing or the panic that has typically been associated with it. So you don't forget anything. It's not like you've suddenly forgotten something that's happened to you. You're just sort of processing it differently and more comfortably.
Is this similar to what might be known as exposure therapy, where you're having the memory again to have a different response to it?
That's a great question. So we do also study exposure therapy, and we study exposure therapy combined with drugs that are somewhat related to MDMA. So the idea there is, again, that you bring back the memory, and that if you, through exposure therapy, relive it over and over and over again, it will stop being so sensitized, right? You'll sort of habituate to it. It won't be so painful anymore. I will say that from my personal experience, going through that process, and for many people, is too painful of reliving the memory over and over and over again. And so one of the remarkable things about MDMA is that it allows you to reaccess that memory without it being so painful. And that's what makes the therapeutic effect, I think, so much more intriguing from a science perspective.
That's great. Thank you. And you mentioned the term neuroplasticity earlier. Is that what you're talking about here with how the changes are happening? Or maybe if you could explain what that is exactly.
So I think what's interesting in the field right now is that neuroplasticity, again, means different things to different people. So originally it had to do with these mechanisms called long-term potentiation, long-term depression, and those were found through a very specific methodology. And now people are looking for other markers that might indicate some form of neuroplasticity. So I'd say it's early days in terms of determining how much psychedelics impact neuroplasticity. But the general idea, I think, that many people right now believe is that perhaps there are critical periods in your brain for learning certain things, and that at the end of that critical period, it closes and it makes it harder to learn certain things. And so I think the best example that many people feel they can gravitate to is that of language. When you're a little child, if you go trotting around the world, you might learn two or three languages before the age of 8, and you'll speak them beautifully and fluently, and they'll be with you forever. But if you try to learn a language after, say, early adolescence, it's actually quite difficult. And what people find is that they never fully embrace that language. When they get older, perhaps it's something that they lose again. When they're quite old, they don't remember it at all, et cetera. And the idea is maybe there's a critical period for a language acquisition. Maybe there's a critical period for visual acuity. Maybe there's a critical period for social and emotional learning. The idea is that perhaps the psychedelics reopen that critical period for social and emotional learning. And I think it should come as no surprise to people that it, based on animal models, it looks like that critical period closes at the end of adolescence, and that it is most active perhaps during adolescence. And if you've ever had an adolescent in your house, you're probably likely to agree with that statement. And so one of the interesting things that MDMA appears to do is to reopen that critical period so that an adult animal, and these are again animal models, suddenly looks like an adolescent in terms of how they want to interact with other animals. So the idea here is, again, that on a physiological level, that form of plasticity may allow for additional learning. You know, you can't teach an old dog new tricks, right? Mm-hmm. So you get a new dog, basically, for a period of a few hours to a few weeks. Maybe psychedelics allow you to be a new dog.
Dr. Jennifer Mitchell, there has been research into psychedelics since the 1950s. Why has it taken us so long to get to the point we're at now in understanding their benefits?
Oh, that's an interesting question. So I think there are a few reasons. The first is that in the late 60s and early 70s in this country, psychedelics sort of went into the general population and they were widely used and they scared a lot of people. And so the DEA came along and they scheduled them, and they didn't just sort of schedule them. They put them in the most restrictive DEA category. So they put them in Schedule 1. It says that they have no medical use and that they're highly addictive. So we believe both of those statements to be wrong, but I think that they were a response to the sort of social ethos of the time. That made them very difficult to study scientifically because it meant that there was no money available through state or federal sources to do so. And so it's taken us a long time to catch up, and it's taken us a long time, I think, to sort of calm down from the panic of the late 60s and early 70s and say, you know, maybe under the right conditions and in the right hands, those are very powerful and effective medicines. Maybe some of the indigenous groups that have been using them for thousands of years got it right. And maybe we should turn and look at how they've been doing it and figure out how we can get it right ourselves.
Is it difficult to get research funded now with the legal implications?
It's kind of painful, frankly. I mean, we've relied primarily on philanthropy for the past 8 years, which is something that I'm absolutely grateful for. And at the same time, I wish the federal government would get on board more quickly and help continue these research studies, because I think that they could be very fruitful. And because I think that it's time to acknowledge that some of the doctrine that especially was prevalent in the 80s was not true. It was sort of scare tactics. And so my generation was raised on eggs in frying pans, and this is your brain on drugs. And then, right, with like a big black hole in the middle. I still remember that one. That's this is ecstasy. This is your brain on ecstasy. You know, I was like, what's the big black hole from? That doesn't even make sense neurologically, right? I don't yet know if it is toxic under some conditions and at some doses. That's something that we have to investigate. What we do know is that it can be safe and effective at this dose in this population.
And do we know anything now about the long-term implications of the drugs? Do we know how long the benefits last, for example? Do people have to continue long-term, or is it a one dose and you're better?
It's not a one and done. I think a lot of people are hoping that it will be a one and done. What is intriguing about the psychedelics is that they do appear to be particularly durable treatments. Mm-hmm. So for psilocybin and MDMA, I think they're the most data. Those data suggest that for some populations, after 1 to 3 doses, which was pretty minor when you think about the general scheme of things, 1 to 3 doses of a drug, you're better for years. But most people, I'm thinking, are going to need a touch up every so many years. Maybe the depression might trigger back in, or maybe you will have another trigger in your life and you'll need to go back again for another round of therapy. But the idea here is that psychedelics could be quite different from some of the other drugs that are considered gold standard treatments that you have to take every day. And you have to take them every day forever, like SSRIs. And so the idea is that maybe there'd be a lot more freedom and a lot more opportunity for growth if you instead were enabled to take a psychedelic.
How much is the field suffering now from reputational issues? Is it difficult for people to take the science seriously because of the associations with recreational drug use?
I think for many people it is. Some people have come around to acknowledging that to many substances, there's both good and bad. I mean, I think often of cancer treatments. Mm-hmm. Cancer treatments are going to kill you if you have to do them for long enough, right? The hope mm-hmm. is that you can get rid of the cancer before you kill the host. Radiation is something I wouldn't want to see everyone get to play with, but we know that radiation is a very important therapeutic at this point in our development as a species. So I sort of think of the psychedelics similarly, like, you know, in the right hands, they're very powerful tools.
Has the research shown any risks or downsides to psychedelic therapies?
Well, it's early days. So again, I caution people, just because we haven't found that many risks doesn't mean that they might not eventually pop up, especially in certain subgroups. But I think that the largest risk from my perspective is still that these compounds shouldn't be used in certain populations with predispositions or with other like comorbidities, other diagnoses that could make the drugs dangerous. So we screen out people that have a family history of schizophrenia. I don't believe the drugs should be used in individuals that have personality disorders or that have certain cardiac conditions that could be exacerbated by these drugs. I think it's really important to be well screened by a healthcare team before you engage in psychedelic therapy.
How do you think we should view these drugs and their potential going forward?
I think one of the most interesting things about psychedelics is that they're sort of power, you know, power in a pill, power in a mushroom. And because they're power, they have a tendency to be somewhat scary. So sort of like radiation, where you think, okay, that could be very healing, but obviously you have to be very careful. And so my personal feeling is that we have to be very careful, that we don't want to repeat some of the mistakes of the late 60s and early 70s and just go crazy and think that they're safe and everyone should try them. And I think that we want to tread carefully and slowly to make sure that we really understand these substances and how best to use them so that we can help all the people that need help without panicking and, you know, triggering this sort of backlash and shutting the door for another 30 to 40 years.
Joining us today on Peace Talks Radio is Shannon Miller, a licensed clinical social worker and owner of Apricity Expat Therapy based in the U.S. Shannon Miller, can you explain what we're talking about when we say psychedelic assisted therapy? What does that mean?
So this is going to be pretty much the leading edge of psychological care in the future. We're talking about things like MDMA, psilocybin, LSD, anything that alters the state that we've previously considered a hallucinogenic. It is a hallucinogenic. It's just they also have therapeutic purposes.
And how are these substances used therapeutically?
Basically, we're treating them currently as like a therapy accelerant would be maybe the best way to describe it, where we're developing protocols and the protocol for MDMA is established, and it would be prep sessions leading up to it. And then you would have a one dose time, like a whole day session. And then you meet immediately the next day to sort of process everything. And then we have integration sessions, which is just a fancy term for let's talk about what came up for you while you were taking the medication. And then specifically with MDMA, then we would do another dose. And then that completes, I think it's three rounds of it for the complete course of treatment as what's getting approved by the FDA. What we're seeing at the end of those three sessions is that people that tested pretty high on what we call the CAPS-5, which is our screener for PTSD, they are then at subclinical levels for the symptoms and they remain there well into the future. So there wouldn't be a need to do it again.
What about psilocybin? How are we understanding what that is doing for people therapeutically?
So what we're coming to understand is that it's happening on two levels. There is a biochemical thing happening in the brain where it allows both sides of the brain to better talk to each other, and it builds neuroplasticity. And it's during that window of neuroplasticity that we can get in there with some really good therapy and build the new neural networks. The other thing that's happening is, again, under the influence of psilocybin, we don't get hung up on details or fluidity of stories and things like that. Things just come at us in pieces, and we seem to know what to do with it without getting caught on the details. You just sort of flow with it a bit better, and it's more of a perceived sense of what you have to do rather than something that can be articulated. You kind of don't need words in the experience. You just know.
Are there other forms of therapy that are used to access that besides psychedelic supported?
Yeah, I mean, often that's what mindfulness is. And when people meditate, they sort of get in touch with that part of themselves that's just very calm and sort of, it's just knowing. So we can get to it lots of different ways that just IFS or internal family system seems to dovetail very well with the psychedelic assisted therapies. And again, okay. It's assisted therapy. It doesn't do any good if you stop doing therapy. Then you're just going and getting high.
Do you find that to be a difficult concept for people who are not familiar with the therapy to wrap their heads around, that it's not just about taking the substances, that this is part of a therapeutic package?
I think for people that are just sort of on the outside of it and don't really know much about it, if people are seriously interested in it, I think they absolutely understand that and welcome it. But I think it is a bit of a PR obstacle to overcome in the beginning.
Who is psychedelic assisted therapy for? Who should consider trying this approach?
Really, it could be for anybody. Anybody who wants to deepen their work on themselves, their own self-awareness, process unresolved things, just gain a better sense of self. It's really open to anybody. Anybody who just wants to explore, even. There doesn't have to be significant trauma that we're absolutely going to sort through. Although, as a therapist, I would say I would probably give preference to the people that are really sorting through something, but really it's not limited to just that.
Can you tell me more about the integration sessions? So these are therapy sessions after someone has taken the drugs. What happens during these?
It's more of, you know, what was that like for you? What did that mean? It's just really letting the person sort of process and metabolize the experience out loud. What we find that the MDMA does is it allows you to get in touch with what we call that inner healing intelligence, and the belief being that we have everything we need to heal inside of us. We just have things that are blocking our access to it. And the MDMA sort of softens those blocks that we can get to it and do the things that we need to do in order to heal.
What are those blocks?
Guilt, shame. A lot of times what we're dealing with as well is PTSD is the catch-all term that we tend to use, but there's also moral injury in there, where it means that somebody witnessed or participated in something that's such an affront to their morals that they then have to reorganize how they see the entire world. And wrapped up in that is a lot of guilt and shame and not knowing what to do with it. And under MDMA, you just sort of know what you have to deal with it. Or you're more open to being able to process it and get to find out what you've got to deal with it. It lowers the inhibition of shame and guilt, and there's more of a love and an acceptance there, both for yourself and for those around you.
Is inner healing intelligence something that people are able to access in different ways? Is this something that is accessible via other types of supportive therapy?
Right. So one of the methodologies that I practice quite a bit is called internal family systems, or IFS. And it's hopefully, in the world I go in, it's getting a lot of traction. I hope it's becoming more and more mainstream. But it's this idea that we're made up of a collection of parts, right? And the movie Inside Out does a great job of illustrating that. But that inner healing intelligence is that part of you that is a bit dispassionate, meaning it's non-emotional, it's just observational, and it just kind of knows. Some of us might call it intuition. We all have different words for it, but that's that part of us that's just like, yep, I knew that's exactly how it had to happen. It's that inner intelligence there.
Are there other types of mental health conditions or situations that it's also found to be beneficial for besides trauma or PTSD?
Well, it depends on which substance we're referring to. MDMA right now is just specifically for PTSD. And I think more research is going on for depression and anxiety and things like that. And a lot of research is being done right now on the effects of psilocybin for depression and anxiety.
What should people know who are considering trying psychedelic supported therapy? What should they consider before doing it?
I would say that this is an experience that can make somebody very, very vulnerable. And so they need to be very confident in the person of whom they choose to guide them and to be present with them. Because of its legal status, if people are choosing to do it before it's entirely legal, making sure that one, they have a therapist that's willing to be a trip sitter with them. I think asking your therapist, hey, come do psychedelic assisted therapy with me is a no-go. Therapists are not going to be willing to do that because they value their licenses. But you have to really trust the person you're with because it does put you in a vulnerable state. That's my number one thing that I would say for people.
So because of the legality of some of these substances, what should someone be looking for in a guide to walk them through trying psychedelic supported therapy?
I think that you have to shop around for your guides. You don't just want, you know, like some guy that's really cool and has a hookup. I do think that there is becoming standardized care. I don't believe that there's any standardized, manualized care for psilocybin right now. There is for MDMA, and that would be getting your training through MAPS or an organization that they support. For psilocybin, I think it's coming very soon because the sort of reading the tea leaves says that psilocybin will be up next for approval. And in order to get that, there has to be manualized care. But do your research on who you're letting guide you and check to see where they've done their studying of it. Not just, hey, I want to do this and it's really cool. I don't think you're going to get much out of it in terms of therapy. Or if your therapist you're currently working with, bring it up with them. And they may know somebody or tell you the best way to go about doing it or what to look for.
Shannon, is there anything else you'd want people to know about this type of treatment?
Therapy has to be a part of it, or it's just getting high. You got to do the work. You can't just go and take some drugs and say, oh, I'm healed. It doesn't work like that. And in fact, science is showing us that the therapy part of it is essential. Therapists, they need to do their work going into it as well and recognizing their own vulnerabilities while in relationship with these people, while being a trip sitter.
That was Shannon Miller, a licensed clinical social worker and owner of Apricity Expat Therapy. We also heard from Dr. Jennifer Mitchell, a professor in the UCSF Department of Neurology and Associate Chief of Staff for Research and Development at the San Francisco VA. Earlier on the program, we heard from Sean, a humanitarian aid worker from the UK, on her experience trying therapeutic psilocybin. You can find links to some of the Spotify playlists used during psychedelic therapy sessions at peacetalksradio.com. For more information about our guests, to see photos and to link to their bios, or to read more about the therapeutic use of psychedelic drugs, go to peacetalksradio.com. That's where you can go to hear all the programs in our series dating back to 2002. You can also sign up for our podcast, drop us a line, tell us what you liked or learned from one of our programs, and make a donation to keep this program going into the future, all at peacetalksradio.com. Support comes from listeners like you. Also, the McCune Charitable Foundation and the Albuquerque Community Foundation Ties Fund. Support, too, from KUNM at the University of New Mexico. Nola Daves-Moses is our executive director. Allie Adelman composed and performs our theme music. For series producer Paul Engels and correspondent Daniel Price, I'm Jessica Tickton. Thanks so much for listening to and for supporting Peace Talks Radio.